Uh-oh. Where's my book? Excuse me. Where is it? Oh, that's right, because I was, okay. Inside baseball. We're doing communion today, and I have the communion scriptures in here, but we, for the worship team, because it's really hard to play instruments and take the elements of communion, we do it in the back. So this is my teaching. I could have stood up here and winged it, because Erica said two words that I thought this could be my first tattoo. And that's Ventura Confused. I'm Brian, and I'm Ventura Confused. Part of it, I got to admit, anytime this time of year, you start thinking, oh, it's Thanksgiving and big meals and Winterfest because it's Christmas and it's 76 degrees and I'm wearing shorts and flip-flops and I'm confused. But that's my general state. I'm one of several members of the teaching team here, and as we always say, if you don't like me, you'll probably like the next person better. Today, we'll be continuing our series called The Theology in Song, which, that title and this series, it's been exciting for me, but it's also been super intimidating in a way, because it's not like taking a piece of scripture and expounding on it or telling a story specifically. You're looking at stories told in song, and there are many. And it was hard for me to choose, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But if this is your first time with us, or you're here on a regular, and you've missed one of these part of this series or any teaching, it's on liminalventura.org. You can find that there. I've named this installment in our series after a line from a song that actually came in second place to the song that I'm going to do today, and it's because of this lyric. If we could. A million young poets screaming out their words to a world full of people just living to be heard. Future generations riding on the highways that we built. I hope they have a better understanding. Right? A better understanding. That's from the song Check It Out by John Mellencamp. It was his album, The Lonesome Jubilee, probably one of his greatest albums. He's definitely a bard and a poet. I offer this up as a way to set the stage for today's teaching also. I think it speaks to the offerings given by all the prior teachers. In a grand sense, this lyric speaks of something that's meaningful to most writers, that their words are heard, be it song, a poem, a novel, a stage performance, film, or how about the spoken word, or a sermon, perhaps. By taking time to consider the written word, we learn, we understand that those words could move us, cause us to feel, to think, and in some cases, honestly, to act. For me, there are so many songs that I considered, and I'll just give you a short smattering. Best of You by the Foo Fighters, because I think those words speak to me daily. Are people getting the best of me? Are the people getting the best of you? Are you being your best self? And I have to be honest, for myself, that's not the truth. I fail hourly, if not daily. Am I giving the best of me? Holiday, Boulevard of Broken Dreams by Green Day. That comes up because I think it speaks to maybe the angst of our times, and it was written, 20 years ago. Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel. That line about your eyes look like the light of 1,000 churches. I've always thought that would make a great worship song, and plus I'm a big fan of Peter Gabriel because he's short and bald. Also, his remake of David Bowie's song, Heroes, which is considered one of the greatest pop songs ever written, but his remake of it is so emotional and compelling. He did it as a tribute to David Bowie after he passed, and it's beautiful if you haven't listened to it. Losing My Religion by R.E.M., a little too on the nose, maybe, maybe a little difficult in a church, but still a beautiful song. My Guitar Gently Weeps was actually what I put out when our team first said, oh, we're going to do this, because I think that's also a profound song by the Beatles. Harrison wrote it. It was a real mixed bag for me. The list went on, and I'm sure if you ask any of the other teachers, they probably say the same thing. that this was a problem. So many songs, not enough time. As a person of a certain age, I went with an album from my childhood, all right? This is the Hotel California. Hotel California was released, to get this, hold on to your seats, those of you that are familiar with it, December the 8th, 1976. That's almost, we're just a couple years away from that album being 50 years old, right? And thanks. Yeah, I know. And by the way, it's been impossible to escape ever since. You can check out, but you can't leave, right? Never mind the music. The album cover, take a look at it behind me, is iconic. And for those of you that were around the church in those days, as I was, this is not a picture of Aleister Crowley's house, who was not nefarious, but definitely a spiritualist that was not embraced by the Christian church, to be sure. Or it's not the Camarillo State Mental Hospital, which is now California State University, Channel Islands, which, yes, right? What's that?
Similar.
Yeah, well, yeah. I had two of my three kids got their undergrads there, so I can't. Anyway, yeah, Sea Sushi is where it's at now. It's a beautiful campus. It is a picture. Does anybody know what it is? Anyone? It's a picture of the Beverly Hills Hotel. And no, you cannot see. It's also not in Camarillo. There's the one Catholic church that's there. Kind of looks like it, too, because I always look at it and think, oh, yeah, on a dark desert highway. Right? No, you cannot see the infamous Anton LaVey in the window. It's actually, it was a model that they hired, a female model, to do that shot. This album is on many top lists of all times. It's 26 times platinum. When I read that, I thought, I didn't know that was a thing. It sold over 32 million units, right? So it paid for a lot of stuff for the members of the Eagles, to be sure. All of this according to the Wikipedia. Who knows, right? I don't know. How many times a day does just the signature song, the song, the namesake of this album, play on Spotify or Amazon Music or on the radio? For those of you who don't know, they used to come in cars. And it had an on-off switch. And when you were in the center of the country, the only thing you could get was like crazy alien talk show hosts at night and a lot of country western between here and in New York. That's a fact. But now it plays on streaming. The Last Resort is the song that I picked for today. It's the last song on the Hotel California album. To be candid, even though it was my first thought, it was not my first choice. I ran from it. Like I said, I went to My Guitar Gently Weeps. Good song, safe song in some ways. Hence the list of the other choices I mentioned. Ultimately, I kept coming back to this song because I found it meaningful. I found it meaningful because of the lyrical content, the music. It's a unique song. It also has a personal history for me. I was 14 years old when the Hotel California was released. I'm sure you're thinking, isn't he like 90? No. But I was 14 when this was released. You can do the math. I was the youngest, to be honest, the dumbest in a family filled with smart people, right? One of the smartest in my family, the most smartest, arguably one of the smartest, to be sure, was my brother John. He died over 10 years ago, and I miss him. But he was a genius. And I know he was a genius because my mother told me so. She said to me one day, you know your brother's a genius. Pause, and she said, we had him tested. He is. All right, Mom. And I learned that from her, but I also learned it firsthand. He was super smart. I spent a fair amount of time with him, hanging around with him when he was home from school. He was in school a lot. He started at what was LABC, it's now the Master's College, went on to go to a premier seminary in Chicago, graduated with an MDiv, and I think also a master of arts in Old Testament languages. He had a comprehensive understanding, I still have his Greek books, of Greek and Hebrew. He always had a book in his hand. Even, just to cite an example, when we were golfing together, seriously, he would put the book down when he would swing and hit the club, but then when I was, he wouldn't even watch my ball, he would sit on the bench and read. And then while he was dragging his sorry for those of you online, I'm going to go off camera, he would walk and like miss squirrel holes, which kind of tells you where we golfed, and read while he was dragging his cart of clubs. That was my brother. He was also known as Baruch. As I think I said earlier, his name was John, but he was known as Baruch. For those of you that know random biblical names, anybody know where Baruch comes from? He was the scribe of Jeremiah the prophet, scribe and traveling companion. And there were many people that knew my brother that never knew his name was John. Baruch, they called him. Hey, Baruch. And it fit, because he was a scribe and he was smart. I'll never forget the day we were listening to the newly released Hotel California album, and the aforementioned song on the album came on. After it was over, my brother told me that song is about church history. And what followed for me was the solidifying of what has been a continuing, like, lifelong passion, and that's studying lyrics of songs to try to understand what they mean. Going back to old songs, to new songs of the day, I have an interest, if the song captures me, to really understand what the writer was trying to get at. Also, what followed was a lesson in, well, church history from my brother, which is what we will trace together through this song. From the landing of the pilgrims in this country in 1620, so we're not going all the way back in church history, we're going to start in 1620, bringing with them their beliefs of a city on a hill, the idea that America represented a change and that we ultimately would become an example to the rest of the world. The city on a hill. And all the way from there in 1620 to the 1820 arriving of the missionaries, Christian missionaries from Boston to Hawaii. The lyrics for our song today were written by Don Henley, who in Rolling Stones said that he tried to go Michener on the song. Citing, it's some laugh, right? James Michener, who was known for his epic and very detailed style of writing. Henley was always actually kind of struggled with the song. As I think it was Scorsese that said once, you don't ever finish a film, you abandon it. Because at some point, you have to decide that's the final product. And I think that it's got to be the same because the song is so specific. And to write a hit song, I mean, the annals of song are filled with one-hit wonders. They can do it once, but they can't repeat it. The Eagles certainly have done that. And Henley, as a writer, has repeated it over and over again. So without any more preamble, let's get to the song. I warn you, it's not a short pop song. It's not made for the radio, that's for sure. I ask you to just sit back, take the words and the images in.
It's like a bear. when the chilly winds blew down across the desert, through the canyons of the coast to the Malibu, where the pretty people play, hungry for power to light their neon way, give them things to do. Rich men came and raped the land. Nobody caught her. Put up a bunch of ugly boxes, and Jesus, people bought them. They called it paradise, the place to be. They watched the hazy sun sinking in the sea.
Song from the 70s without that synthesizer riff. When they redid it live, if you look at when the Hell Freezes Over tour, Don Henley did the synth actually on the album. That's not in there. Instead, they had a full orchestra, which was pretty epic. How many of you have heard that song before? Okay, that's actually more than I was expecting. It doesn't get a lot of airplay. I will say this. Last week, Catherine Anderson spoke, and she chose a song called Graceland, which was a metaphor with Elvis tones. And by the name Graceland, it kind of speaks to it, Elvis's house. Which, last week, I thought Jeremy, if he would have just thought about it, at the end of the service, he should have said, "Let us pray." But he didn't, so I thought, there's an opportunity for me to say it. So if last week's was a metaphor, then this song is a history lesson coupled with an accusation and a gut punch, especially within the church. Because that last line, I don't know Henley's belief system or any of that, but he's asking a really profound question. If we call something paradise, when you look at the history throughout the world, we've jacked up any place that we've called paradise. And that's a valid question. Not going to get into that today. In fact, I'll touch on that in a minute. She came from Providence, one in Rhode Island, where the old world shadows hang heavy in the air. She packed her hopes and dreams like a refugee, just as her father came across the sea. So now it's time for a quick 75-second refresher. I did time it. Of church history as it applies to the migration to North America. Henry VIII needed a divorce, so he split from the Catholic Church to create the Protestant Anglican Church, also known as the Church of England. Queen Mary I followed Henry, tried to get us back, the UK back to Catholicism. Didn't work out so well. Queen Elizabeth I ascended to the throne after Mary, and she kept the path between Rome on one hand and the Protestantism on the other, and kind of walked in between the two. This was a time when there was a lot of people in England that followed a theologian by the name of John Calvin. You may have heard of him in Germany, big fan of predestination, who came after Martin Luther nailed his complaints to the Wittenberg door in Germany, right? He started the Reformation, this little thing. Many of Queen Elizabeth's subjects that followed Calvin thought the Church of England was not Protestant enough, not enough protesting for them. This was a view shared by a group that we are all familiar with because they were called the Puritans. They said, "We're out," and a group of them went to Holland, right? James I, right, took the throne after the death of Elizabeth. He was not on board with Calvin's thinking, much to the distress of the Puritans. He is remembered for the King James Bible, right? Can't escape it. But besides this, he was overall a reactionary. As king, he ordered strict adherence to the Anglican Church, following the Church Book of Common Prayer. If you didn't conform, you risked arrest and imprisonment, right? It became compulsory. You were arrested, tried, and imprisoned. The Puritans were very strong of conscience, not willing to conform, so they left. One group went to Holland and then came across the sea on a boat called... the Mayflower. They headed off to the New World of North America to create a pure non-political church, non-political because they and us well know the politics by extension government can be corrupt. They wanted no part. You can stop your timer. Thank you. Does anyone have any idea who this statue represents? Anyone? Oh, God, thank God. Because I thought if all of you go like, "Yeah, we know who this guy is," I'd be like, "That's it." Because this is where my teaching shifted from some of the intense questions that Henley asked in his story that I'm going to leave for you to dig into later, right? His name is Roger Williams. Anybody now? Anyone? Oh, you know him. Look at that. You know. Two of you. I'm impressed. Are you from the East Coast, perchance? So that would be why. But that's my opinion. Roger Williams. He's an important figure in the history of the Christian Church of North America of the United States. We do not know what he looks like. So this is a rendering in stone by an artist. Just kind of a, you know, this is what I think he looks like, so there's his statue. We also don't know the full date of his birth or his death. We know kind of the time frame. There is a fair amount of his writings that have survived him, which does give us important details. There are also many contemporary records that speak of him. He was a minister. He went to the University of Cambridge. And in 1630, he and his wife Mary followed the Puritans to North America. They wound up having two kids. The two of them settled, and then eventually with their family, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, who were very pleased to welcome an educated theologian. Roger Williams' welcome did not last long. He was a person who spoke and wrote what was on his mind, not just once, but over and over and over and over. He soon found himself embroiled in a conflict with the leadership of the colony when he questioned the grant, also known as the patent, of the land given to the community by the current ruling English king, Charles I. He questioned, I want you to wrap your heads around this, the taking of the land for the Massachusetts Bay Colony that belonged to the Native Americans of the region without compensation. This is 1630, folks. This isn't the 21st century. This is a man that I will argue was way ahead of his time. He said, wait a minute, this is not fair. He dared to argue that the English colonization, and this is a quote, was a sin of unjust usurpation, I'm not smart, upon others' possessions. As you can imagine, this didn't go over well with the Bay Colony, right? That wasn't good. The colonies were not exactly places overflowing with tolerance of others and unfettered religious freedom. To the contrary, they were small kingdoms unto themselves that were under strict control by the colony's administrators, their general court, and the clergy. He didn't stop there. Roger Williams also challenged the idea of a non-believer swearing an oath of allegiance to the colony, ending with, so help me God, which was required of all males 16 of age and above. If a person swearing an oath did not believe in God, it made no sense to Williams, and he openly expressed his opinion. It was ridiculous, he thought. He went on to question public officials enforcing religious duties like church attendance, keeping the Sabbath holy. He believed that believers had a right to choose how they followed the Bible, and the government should not interfere in any way. Sound familiar? We'll get into that in a minute. He eventually went too far with his challenges of authority, and he was banished or condemned to be banished. And then ultimately they decided, you know what, let's not just banish him. They gave him a couple of weeks to pack up his stuff and get his family ready to be banished. And then they decided during that time, you know what, it's just not good to have him hanging around here, no matter where he walks to. So let's send him back to England. And at that time, England was not a safe place for him, certainly with his wide-ranging views on the separation of the government and the church. And so he feared that if he went to England, he's going to go straight to jail or worse. So he ran. When they came to get him at his house, he was gone. His wife was there. He ran. I don't know the mileage. I didn't look it up. But he ran to a place which he named Providence. He was taken in by the Native Americans there. And you wonder why? Because he advocated for them. Not only did he advocate for them, he also, in his tenure, in his lifetime, tried to learn their languages and understand the people. So he was a friend of the Native Americans of North America. He wanted to understand the people that were there before they arrived. He purchased land from them and started his own colony based on religious liberty. That colony would later lead, that he would lead, would become the state of Rhode Island. It was also known as Rogues Island because so many refugees sought freedom in that state. I'll be honest, I'm from California, and I have a certain level of, I don't know, egotism about the fact that we're the state that we are, the size that we are, the population that we are. And I've always thought Rhode Island was cool. I drove through it in like 10 minutes once. And no offense, that's a little pejorative. I'm kidding. But I never really did because I'm not from the East Coast. So I had never heard of Roger Williams. I keep wanting to call him William Wallace. And I think because there's a parallel in some wells. Roger Williams, until weeks ago when I started preparing this teaching today, my brother's church history lesson missed it. So did my high school civics class. It started when I looked up the definition of providence. simply defined as divine guidance or care that guides human destiny. Another click of my mouse led me to a city of Providence, Rhode Island, and the story of its founder. That was when my direction of today's teaching changed. I thought, I gotta talk about this guy, because right now there was two people that knew who he was, but now there's a whole lot more. He was an impressive human. I then read a book called Roger Williams by Edwin Ustad from the Lives and Legacies series of the Oxford University. It was published in 2005, and you can get it on your Kindle. It's well worth the read. It has been a wonderful small journey of knowledge, of a slice of church history that started with the opening lyrics of the song that was just before us. So she came from Providence, one in Rhode Island, where the old world shadows hang heavy in the air. She packed her hopes and dreams like a refugee, just like her father came across the sea. There is much to this song, more than we have time for today. In this song, which is nearly, as I said earlier, 50 years old, a few examples. Henley directly comments on the economic disparity, and how we treat the world in which we live. Problems that have not gone away, but have only gotten worse in the ensuing decades since he wrote this. He calls out humanity for its use of religion in exacting retribution and conquest, a problem that has been around for thousands of years. He asks hard questions and makes statements that are worthy of pondering. Who will provide the grand design, right? What is yours and what is mine? Because there's no more new frontier. We gotta make it here. Next one. We satisfy our endless needs and justify our bloody deeds in the name of destiny and in the name of God. And I will speak to this right now, that's a true statement. But every time governments or churches themselves decide to go like way over here, there's always a group way over here that's willing to stand up against it. I think of St. Francis of Assisi, right, who was involved in the Crusades, and boy, did he change, right? Changed the world. And those lists goes on and on. In the name of destiny, in the name of God. And you can see them there on Sunday morning. Stand up and sing about what it's like up there. They call it paradise. I don't know why. You call someplace paradise, kiss it goodbye. A comment on the last line of the song. Henley ends the song remarking on a church congregation as they look to heaven and beyond while they're on earth. Nothing wrong with looking to heaven if you don't ignore that we have to care for what we're standing on. We must care for what we live upon and who we live with. Love your neighbor as yourself, as Jesus said. Our brief history tour today highlighted profound and relatively unknown and forgotten figure of the Christian church in our country, Roger Williams. He championed the rights of Native Americans long before others. He published a language guide to understand the local tribes of his region. So he published it's almost like Rick Steves, or, you know, you pick one of the travel guides. It was so you could understand the Native Americans of North America. It was amazing in the 1600s. He helped create the doctrine of the separation of church and state. We know the names of Adams, Franklin, Jefferson, Washington, but before them, and they stand on the shoulders of Roger Williams, the founder of the state of Rhode Island. Why have I not ever heard of this man? He now has been added to my list of heroes of the Christian faith. It's a long list, right? But nowhere exhaustive. And I'm sure if I asked you that question, you could come up with several of people. There are so many, ones that we know of. But I will close with this. No matter what troubles have happened or are happening now here in 2025 or going to happen in the future, there will always be people of faith working, caring, and loving in anonymity, being known by their love. Whether those troubles occur to other humans, our planet, our system of government, or within the church itself, may we always strive to act accordingly. So, amen. Transition. Today we're going to do communion. And it's simple elements, right? We have bread. And, you know, this is that kind of the, where it's torn. But this is a simple ingredient to a meal, right? The disciples sat down at what we call the Last Supper. It was their last meal with Jesus before he would be arrested and then crucified. The next meal they had is probably one of the most profound, and that's him cooking fish on the side of the Sea of Galilee, right? That this person that conquered death has the power of the universe in his very hands, and what does he choose to do? To restore Peter and make the disciples breakfast. That always just, it blows my mind. Simple ingredients, bread and a cup. So here at Liminal, all are welcome to this table. We use non-alcoholic juice. There's gluten-free crackers. There's also bread. Just as a matter of instruction, if you want to come up and take communion, we ask you just to come down the two center aisles and then return on the side aisles. We've kind of tried to clear it. Move slowly because it's a black floor in a black room. So, also, when we're finished after worship, I'm going to invite the band to come up now while I read this scripture. Go ahead and get plugged in. Afterwards, if you just take your cups, if you remember them under your chairs so nobody kicks them across the floor, and bring them to the little bussing tray that's in the coffee bar on your way out, we'd appreciate that. So 1 Corinthians 11:23 through 26 says this, starting with verse 23, "For I received from the Lord what I also pass on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, he took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" Please come forward whenever you're moved during worship, and thank you.